Track 14. The second Great Lives character was a man in pursuit of smugglers. Our historian tells the dramatic story of Robert Bliss, excise superintendent in Wells in the late 18th century, and his nemesis, Thomas Franklin.
Smuggling was rife around the English coast. As the verse above suggests, the recipients of the smuggled goods included those with a place in society. Woodford's diary, for example, makes it clear that he was a buyer of smuggled goods. A blind eye was almost universally turned to the activities of the smugglers. Theirs was probably seen as a victimless crime, except, of course, for the Treasury, but not many cared about that. In North Norfolk, though, it was a far from victimless crime. The goods smuggled may have been welcomed, but the practices of the smugglers smacked more of Al Capone's 1930s Chicago than 18th century Hunstanton. It's perhaps ironic that their motivation in both cases was similar: the provision of prohibited liquor in the United States and duty-free liquor in North Norfolk. The smugglers operated in gangs, and pretty vicious gangs too. One of the most prominent gang leaders was King's Lynn man called Thomas Franklin. Born in poverty, illiterate, and employed initially as a labourer, he began his parallel smuggling career in a small way, smuggling tea. By dint of ruthless coercion, organisational skill, and sheer physical presence, he was to become one of the most successful gang leaders in the trade. He was truly a self-made man, and he was to become the bitter enemy and, in time, the nemesis of the hero of this story, Robert Bliss. Robert Bliss was working for the Excise Office in Winchester when, in the spring of 1779, he was offered a promotion to become the Superintendent of Excise based at Wells. The salary was 100 guineas, that's £105 per annum. It's not possible to make a precise comparison with average earnings at the time, but sources suggest that a figure of £17 or £18 would be somewhere near the mark, so it's not surprising that he quickly accepted the role. What's more, since the amount of goods being smuggled in the area for which he would be responsible, broadly the coast between Hunstanton and Stewkey, was thought to be fast growing, he probably anticipated earning large additional sums of prize money. Like Franklin, Bliss, 32 years old and single, was a man with a reputation. In his case, for dedication to his duty, and especially for physical courage in facing down gangs. Franklin would not have welcomed his appointment. If Bliss was under any illusions as to the size of his task, they were soon blown away. He was greeted shortly after arrival with an anonymous threatening letter stating that the writer, claiming 200 adherents, was after you and your followers for your blood. We are determined to have you or any that belong to you. This would have seemed no idle threat. In his book, The Lawless Coast, Neil Holmes told of a contemporary case in which the body of an Essex exciseman had been discovered with all four limbs detached and his face stripped of all its skin. The body could only be identified because the gang had left a note of his name on a scrap of paper with the body, presumably because they wanted to ensure that it was known that this was the fate of an exciseman. But despite the threats, Bliss went to work with a will. He'd inherited a number of colleagues, one of whom soon told him about Franklin, who operated with a partner called Kemble, who was responsible for shipping and landing the contraband. Franklin would then be responsible for the distribution, both to London, but also locally, where he became the supplier to many local taverns, relatively openly. The trade was widely recognised, and Franklin became popular with the locals in recognition for what he was able to supply. In turn, his popularity helped him to recruit new members of his gang. He was believed to have a reserve of about 200 staff in each of several locations who helped with landing, transporting the goods, and when necessary, becoming an armed escort to fend off rivals or excise men. His new local colleagues were, perhaps from experience, a little less enthusiastic about targeting the activities of Franklin, except with the support of a large squad of dragoons, and Bliss made contact with the nearest troop, billeted at Holt. His meeting with their captain was unproductive. The latter declined to be involved with the pursuit of smugglers, claiming his troop were better trained to put down urban disturbances. Bliss was also warned that to employ local militia volunteers was unwise. Their competence and, most importantly, their loyalty was unclear. As amateur soldiers living in the community, they might well prove susceptible to the popularity of Franklin and change sides in mid-engagement. Frustrated, Bliss repeatedly approached the War Office for military support and eventually was rewarded with the arrival of a regiment dispatched to Norfolk with a specific instruction to assist the officers of the revenue. Bliss, who had spent the interim champing at the bit, unsurprisingly set out deliberately to target Franklin's territory. His expeditions, always accompanied by a dozen dragoons as well as his own colleagues, must have been a major irritant to Franklin. For the next 2 years or so, Bliss scored success after success. In one raid at Hunstanton, he confiscated more than 1,000 gallons of gin, as well as large quantities of tea and camphor. In another, 1,200 gallons of liquor were unearthed at Thornham. The range of hiding places employed by the smugglers was huge. In one case, the location was the tower of Old Hunstanton Church, which was duly raided on Christmas Eve in 1782 during divine service. The confiscated goods were generally sold at auction, and the prize money boosted the personal incomes of Bliss, his staff and the dragoons. During that period, Bliss had total earnings of something in the order of 10 times his salary. Until sold, the goods had to be stored in the excise warehouse at Wells, which was soon filled to capacity with highly desirable assets, including 3,000 gallons of liquor, an obvious target for a vengeful Franklin and his like. Alerted by Bliss, further troops were sent to defend the premises. Franklin must have been furious. Not only was his income diminishing, but also his reputation. His success depended upon retaining the goodwill of the locals, who were his assistants, his customers and his stormtroopers. Kemble, his partner, became impatient about the level of losses of the goods that he smuggled in. Franklin was under pressure and had to do something about it. Bliss was proving to be in a different league to those excise officials he had had to deal with before. Smarter, braver, better organised, and with military backup, he was a formidable opponent. But Franklin's tactics remained unchanged. They'd worked for him before and reflected both in his own violent approach and the availability of his own private army. He had been particularly humiliated by the Christmas Eve church raid. He had been present, as had many of his occasional staff. He had had no choice but to sit silently and watch his contraband confiscated under his nose, constrained by the presence of local gentry and officials. He wanted revenge, and he wanted it in double-quick time. He was blessed with a degree of cunning, and within 48 hours he had set up a sting for Bliss. On Boxing Day, Bliss and his team were enjoying a belated Christmas feast when he was approached by an informer he had known before and therefore trusted. The gist of the informer's message was that there was a large amount of contraband hidden at specific sites in Thornham, in the heart of Franklin's territory, and that on December the 31st, Franklin himself, with many of his supporters, would be away in King's Lynn celebrating his cousin's wedding. Bliss swallowed the story whole and shared it with his dragoon officers. They were all excited at the prospect of raiding the village and boosting their prize money in a raid where the risk, because of the absence of Franklin, was minimal. When the evening came, Bliss led a party of a sergeant and 6 dragoons together with his own team to Thornham, stopping en route for an anticipatory celebration at an inn. When he arrived in the village, he led his team past the local inn, where he must, perhaps for the first time, have wondered about the veracity of his information. Several horses were tethered outside the pub, from which the sounds of a crowd could be heard. The noise stopped as the party rode past, and he soon found himself confronted by an armed party, with his retreat blocked by the group who had emerged from the pub. He was trapped. Franklin was not in King's Lynn, but in Thornham, at the head of a group of 200 or so locals intent on destroying Bliss. The attackers managed to split the troop of dragoons in two, leaving Bliss and his team isolated in a group of 6, towards which Franklin rode, grabbing Bliss's reins. He began to whip Bliss ferociously across the face and the eye. The sergeant, with great courage, drew his sabre, and grabbing Bliss's reins himself, he rode off at speed with Bliss clinging onto his own horse. Bliss was clearly in extreme pain and bleeding profusely, but such was the sergeant's courage that his troopers responded, with the result that the group were able to ride away, discouraging any pursuit by the use of their firearms. Eventually, they reached a surgeon at whose house they left Bliss, unconscious and blinded in one eye, with damage to the other, before making their way back to Wells. Bliss survived, but was a spent force. Franklin had got his revenge. Neither were the same again, though. Franklin survived his trial for the assault, largely because of the testimony, presumably perjured, of many that he had not been at Thornham, but his credibility had gone, and he became just a minor player in the smuggling game. The outturn for Bliss was worse. He felt unable to return to his role, and his performance deteriorated to the extent that, first having moved in the excise service, dismissed him without pay, without compensation, and without a pension. Appalling treatment of a man of courage, of determination, and imbued with a great sense of duty. Thus far, my research has failed to reveal anything later in the life of this remarkable man. One can only hope that his earnings in the early years at Wells were enough to sustain him in his enforced retirement. He was a man whose life we should honour.
So that brings us to the end of this June edition of the Chatterbox Norfolk Magazine. We all hope you've enjoyed hearing about the people, places and things going on in the county. Our thanks go to readers John Francis, Caroline Aldry, Matthew Tucker and Carolyn Wood, to Emma Lee, editor of the print edition, to contributors Oscar Lawrence, Jolanda Rocklin, Margaret Brecknell and Chris Armstrong. And finally, thanks to sound recordist Catherine Rose. So until the next time, from me, your editor, Sarah Lusher, goodbye.